It is Monday, April the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Palestinian protests turn violent in Gaza will continue through May 15th.
It will be the 70th anniversary of what Israel calls independence, what the Palestinians call the Nakba or the disaster.
China's loss of a spacecraft might not affect their space program.
Once they get this large space station, they also have a robotic lunar program. It's very probable that they'll put the two together and aim for a human flight to the moon.
We'll also have the latest trend on social media, plus something from the world of entertainment. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Israel's defense minister has rejected calls for an inquiry into the killing of 15 Palestinians by the Israeli military during a Palestinian demonstration that turned violent on Friday at the Gaza-Israel border. One report indicated 1,400 Palestinians were wounded in the incident and that around 750 of them were wounded with live gunfire. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Middle East scholar Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College.
As an analyst who examines the Arab-Israeli conflict, I mean, I myself am tempted to say, well, exactly what kind of protest do you want Palestinians to do to express their grievances? Because it seems like shooting, and the Palestinian health authorities are saying that up to 800 were injured by gunfire. Now, I don't know if those are accurate, but certainly hundreds were injured beyond the 15 that were killed. And all of this is taking place on the Gaza side of the border, mind you. So it's a bit hard to understand exactly how Palestinians are expected to express their grievances toward Israel in a way that isn't either demonized or that doesn't lead them to be killed. I think the second point of significance is that it's showing that there is now a renewed effort by Palestinians to try to break the logjam, not diplomatically, because that has basically frozen the peace process, but that ordinary Palestinians are saying, notably in Gaza, but elsewhere too, that on this day of great significance, it goes back to 1976, the day of the land, we're going to express the fact that we are here and our grievances are still here, regardless of the peace process, the quartet, the Americans, the EU. And I think that, along with other symbols around the world, such as American students demanding safety from guns, it's an interesting portending of things that could come if real progress in terms of the peace process isn't made.
The Israeli military accused Hamas of, quote, cynically exploiting women and children by sending them to the fence area. A Hamas spokesman called the allegations, quote, lies aimed at justifying the massacres.
Well, it certainly is true that while Hamas is the governing authority, the de facto governing authority, this march was put together by a variety of different groups. And it's also, I think, a bit disingenuous for the government of Israel, which has been blockading Gaza, where there is an impending, by many indices, an impending humanitarian disaster that affects women and children. Your listeners should know that Gaza has one of the highest birth rates in the entire world. Probably half of Gaza is made up of people under the age of 20. So that when people speak about the suffering of women and children, I think Israel stands at the front of the line, along with Egypt, in making sure that that suffering goes on through the very intense blockades. I find that a bit disingenuous, and I'm not sure a lot of people will give Israel's claims of Hamas endangering women and children much credence in light of that situation.
This protest is supposed to last weeks and culminate May 15th, when Palestinians mark the so-called Nakba, or catastrophe, when hundreds of thousands fled or were driven out of their homes back in 1948.
I imagine that's true. It will be the 70th anniversary of what Israel calls independence, what the Palestinians call the Nakba, or the disaster. And I do think that it symbolizes a renewed campaign among Palestinian civil society organizations and their allies globally to continue to raise the plight, notably of the refugees, but of the wider lack of resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. You know, much is made of the idea of a two-state solution, issues that the West Bank and Gaza, issues that arose after the 1967 war. But the heart of the dispute and the tragedy between Israel and the Palestinians goes back to 1948, to the refugee exodus, to the destruction of their villages, to the decision not to allow them to return, and so on and so forth. So I do think that the failure of the peace process to lead to anything is actually reigniting among Palestinian organizations and their supporters around the world, raising some of the key issues that predate 1967, that go beyond matters relating to a West Bank and Gaza state, refugees being key among them. And I think it was significant that it was all occurring on the Day of the Land, which is something that commemorates something that happened in 1976, not in the West Bank, not in Gaza, not in refugee camps in Lebanon, but among Palestinian citizens of Israel. And, you know, their fate, too, is something that goes back to 1948, and they wouldn't be affected by a West Bank and Palestinian state, and yet they feel they have grievances, too. So I can well imagine this lasting in the weeks to come, and but where that will ultimately result, what changes, if any, remains to be seen.
Well, does this become a possible new flashpoint in Israeli-Palestinian relations?
I think it could, because with the peace process frozen, with the Palestinian Authority and the government of Mahmoud Abbas in disrepute, Hamas has effectively not brought anything really tangible to the people of Gaza in particular. I can well imagine civil society organizations saying, you know, we're going to do things differently and we're going to do it in our way. And whatever else one thinks about that, certainly the first Intifada back in the late 1980s showed that when popular movements arise and they're not militant, I mean, in the sense that they're not using violence, and the leadership is dispersed and localized, it's very difficult for either Palestinian leaders and especially for Israeli leaders and Israeli military forces to know how to react. Because one thing has been true throughout the Arab-Israeli conflict is the predictability of what the other side is going to do. And this is taking us in a new and unpredictable direction.
Michael Fishbach is a professor of history at Randolph-Macon College, specializing in the history of the modern Middle East, especially that of Palestine, Israel, Jordan, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Chinese Space Authority is reporting that their Tiangong-1 spacecraft re-entered the Earth's atmosphere and largely burned up today over the southern Pacific Ocean. Greg Kulaki is an expert on cross-cultural communication between the United States and China and is China project manager for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He spoke with VOA from Nanjing about the Chinese losing control of the Tiangong-1, but says there is more to the China space program than this one event.
Well, China hasn't had any difficulties with, you know, controlling its satellites or other spacecraft. So I don't think it's the fact that they've lost control of the re-entry of this module is a significant barometer you can use to judge the success or failure of China's space program. For example, just a couple days ago, they launched their 31st of their navigation satellites into orbit. China's building a very robust navigation satellite system to rival the, you know, U.S. GPS satellites, and they're almost done. So in very many areas, China's making, you know, significant progress in space. Human spaceflight, China's experienced some setbacks. The technologies that they're using in these testing in these Tiangong modules you know, they've run into some problems that have delayed by a couple years the planned construction of their human space station.
Joan Johnson Freeze is a professor of national security at the U.S. Naval War College. We asked her about the state of the Chinese space program in comparison to the U.S. space program.
I characterize it as the very, very typical tortoise and the hare. What we did in a decade, they've been doing since 1992, but they're doing it in a way which they have very carefully planned out to have a sustained program, whereas the United States, we went to the moon, looked around, and even canceled some of our last missions. The Chinese have really studied that Apollo playbook and intend to pursue their space program towards incremental steps forward that once they get this large space station, they also have a robotic lunar program. It's very probable that they'll put the two together and aim for a human flight to the moon.
The Tiangong-1, which means Heavenly Palace in English, was the largest man-made object to re-enter Earth's atmosphere in a decade. And before re-entry, it was about the size of a school bus and weighed about 8.5 tons. It was launched in 2011 and served as an orbiting laboratory for the manned Chinese space missions until officials determined its lifespan was complete. It was taken out of service about 2 years ago. Over the weekend, Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai burst into tears, according to family friends. She took a deep breath as she entered her childhood home in the Swat Valley of Pakistan for the first time since she was shot there by the Taliban 6 years ago. Reuters' Gillian Kitchener reports.
It was uncertain whether Malala would even be able to visit the neighborhood due to security concerns. The roads were blocked off in the town as Malala, her parents, and her brother were flown in by a military helicopter. The visit reportedly lasted about 90 minutes. And according to Malala, who spoke at her hotel on Friday, the trip back to Pakistan was full of raw emotion.
I don't compare coming to Pakistan with anything. It has been the most beautiful day of my life. This has been the most important thing in my life. And I had never been so excited for anything. I had never been so happy before.
The Taliban claimed responsibility in 2012 for the attack on Malala when she was only 15 years old for her outspoken advocacy for girls' education, which was forbidden under the militants' rule over Swat and their harsh interpretation of Islamic law.
And all of that gave Malala more resolve. A new girls' school built with her Nobel Prize money has now opened in the region where the attack took place. Over the weekend, Pope Francis led an Easter service in which he baptized 8 adults, including a formerly undocumented Nigerian migrant beggar who became a hero when he disarmed an Italian thief wielding a cleaver.
Gian Francesco, vuoi ricevere il battesimo nella fede della Chiesa che tutti insieme abbiamo professato?
Sì, lo voglio.
Gian Francesco, io ti battezzo nel nome del Padre, del Figlio e dello Spirito Santo.
Tens of thousands of faithful underwent heavy security checks entering the Vatican St. Peter's Square for Easter services that were led by Pope Francis. And now we turn to VOA's Lori London, who's joining us with what's trending on social media. What you got there, Lori?
Well, Steve, we'll start with a disturbing but important story. We have seen the photos, many of them very heartbreaking, of children wounded and trapped in the horror of war in Syria, and many that have gone viral because of social media. And several years ago, a young girl's plea for help that went viral, Bana Alabed, she's since become a very well-known face of the conflict and one who was fortunate enough to get out of the country. But Syrian children are still suffering, and they're still continuing to use social media to plead for help. They're using Facebook, Twitter, and others to ask the world to do something. And it's truly heartbreaking to know that these kids are helpless victims of this continuing conflict. But in an example that they are continuing to use social media to plead for help, another young person is asking the world to do something. Mohammed Najem is 15 years old. He survived the government offensive in eastern Ghouta. He's now in Idlib, and he has over 24,000 followers on Twitter. His latest tweet says, quote, "We know that you got bored from our blood pictures, but we will continue appealing to you, Bashar al-Assad, Putin, Khamenei. Killed our childhood. Save us before it is too late. What is the world which can send machines to the Martian and can't do anything to stop killing people?" He also recorded it in a video on the Twitter post, and you could hear the bombs going off in the background. Very difficult to watch and to hear, but obviously these kids, like kids here in the U.S. who are protesting and going on Twitter to plead for stronger gun control, these kids are using social media to try to get some help. And now to social media here in the United States. President Trump is using his favorite form of communication to criticize online retail giant Amazon. The criticism of Amazon really started last Thursday with this, quote, "I have stated my concerns with Amazon long before the election. Unlike others, they pay little or no taxes to state and local governments, use our postal system as their delivery boy, causing tremendous loss to the U.S., and are putting many thousands of retailers out of business." And he's been continuing that throughout the weekend, the criticism of Amazon. But VOA's fact checker says Trump's misrepresenting Amazon's record on taxes. It says the U.S. Postal Service's financial situation and the contract that has the post office deliver some Amazon orders. Federal regulators have found that that contract is profitable for the Postal Service. People who buy products also, by the way, sold by Amazon pay sales tax in all states that have a sales tax. And as for the post office, package delivery has been a bright spot for a service that's lost money for 11 straight years. Losses are mostly because of pension and health care costs, not the business deal for the post office to deliver packages for Amazon. Most analysts agree Trump is upset about Amazon because its owner, Jeff Bezos, owns the Washington Post, one of the targets of his fake news tweets. Steve?
And many thanks to you, Lori. That is VOA's Lori London. And this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says, according to computer models, galaxies are created when dark matter clumps together. In other words, you usually can't find a galaxy without a good amount of dark matter. That is until a recent discovery that has been detailed in the journal Nature. A group of astronomers who used both ground-based telescopes and NASA's Hubble Space Telescope found an odd galaxy out there that they say has very little, if any, dark matter. According to the study, the galaxy called NGC 1052 DF2, which is as big as our Milky Way, only contains about 1/400th the amount of dark matter that was expected. The study's lead author, Peter Van Dokkum of Yale University, says the stars in the galaxy can account for all its mass. There doesn't seem to be any room for dark matter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now, a little something from the world of entertainment.
For two and two for tea, just me for you and you for me alone.
That's Hollywood legend, singer, actress, and philanthropist Doris Day, who celebrates her 96th birthday this week. Retired for quite some time, she lives in Carmel, California, her adopted hometown. And when asked why she gave up show business to spend all of her time supporting animal welfare, Doris Day said that's not exactly what happened.
I didn't really decide to leave show business. I wasn't going to do that at all. I moved out of Los Angeles up to Carmel. And I would have worked, you know, if I could have found something that I really loved. And I still might do that. Nothing is over till it's over.
T for Two was one of Doris Day's biggest hits. It was released in 1950 as part of the soundtrack of a film by the same name.
Picture you upon my knee. T for two and two for tea. Me for you and you for me alone.
Besides acting in 39 hit movies, Doris Day also had two successful TV series. And in 1975, she had the ever-popular singer-songwriter John Denver on her variety show.
I'm so happy to have you on my show. It's terrific.
Doris, I'm thrilled to be here. I mean, me and Doris Day, that is far out.
Behave yourself, John. I'm old enough to be your idol.
Further out. You know, Doris, we could have been in all of those movies together. All of them.
Yeah, if you'd only been born.
Yeah. I like your hair.
I like yours.
I like your singing.
I like yours.
I like your smile.
I like yours.
I like your freckles.
I think we're in a rut.
I think you're terrific.
And I think you are too.
Lucky that we wound up exactly like you. I bought all your records.
Yeah,
hey, Sarah's a guest.
Teacher's pet's my favorite.
Can I stay after class?
Oh, boy, can you ever. Hey, you've even got my nose.
I've got freckles on my toes. I love those late, late shows.
I'm telling you, there's no greater pair.
Can't argue there.
John, I dig your glasses. They're strictly entree new. Hey, you can tell me. You really need them?
Doris, where are you?
You need them.
When I was a toddler, only two or three, people saw the likeness.
That wasn't me. That was not me. No.
I have always envied all the things you've done.
Even kissing Rock Hudson?
Let's say all but one.
Let's say on old time movie lots. The lovers never got the hots.
Those boy meet girl type plots. With us, we got a brand new switch.
Which was which?
The lawyer's getting nervous.
Oh, yeah. He thinks John could sue.
I might get judgment exactly like you.
I didn't get it. I didn't get it.
I'll wait. Why do you think I'm glad I look like you?
You know, you're right, John. We look so much alike that people could easily get us mixed up. You know?
No way. No way.
What do you mean, no way? Give me one good reason.
Doris, I'll give you three. The third one's our names. John Denver Dutchendorf and Doris Marianne Kappelhoff.
Dutchendorf and Kappelhoff. Sounds like a song.
Yeah, like Dutchendorf and Kappelhoff.
No, John, that's Kappelhoff and Dutchendorf.
In 1956, Doris Day starred in the Alfred Hitchcock film The Man Who Knew Too Much. Her co-star was Jimmy Stewart. In that film, she introduced the song Que Sera Sera, which went on to win the Academy Award for Best Original Song.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera, what will be, will be.
In 1978, Doris Day founded the Doris Day Animal Foundation to help care for neglected animals and has kept up that work ever since. Day's only child is Terry Melcher, son of Day's first husband, Al Jordan, and adopted by her third husband, film producer Martin Melcher. Terry is a musician and record producer who was instrumental in shaping the 1960s California sound and the folk rock movements. Kay said I,
what will be, now I have children of my own, they ask their mother, what will I be? Will I be handsome? Will I be rich? I tell them tenderly. Kay said I, said I, whatever will be, will be. The future's not ours to see. Kay said I, said I, what will be, will be. Kay said I, said I.
Mighty nice. I remember seeing that film at the theater. I was just a child, so you know how old I am. One other story for you. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, he had a great time. He clapped his hand, his wife, all kinds of people were there. You know why? Because South Korean pop stars, the Red Velvet, that's a popular girls band, went up to Pyongyang to hang out with Kim Jong-un and his family, and it's all part of that thawing of ties between the rivals after years of heightened tensions, as you might imagine, over the North's nuclear program. Hey, listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're in Washington, hoping you have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 12th, Côte d'Ivoire's Ministry of Health and Public Hygiene hosted its inaugural meeting in Abidjan on the strategic direction of the first nationwide study on the impact of HIV, which has involved more than 20,000 individuals to date. The study, called the Côte d'Ivoire Population-Based HIV Impact Assessment, or CIFIA, aims to test a national representative sample of Ivoirians and then use statistical models to measure the current HIV epidemic in Côte d'Ivoire. The CIFIA is funded by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, known as PEPFAR. Côte d'Ivoire is one of the up to 13 countries poised to achieve HIV-AIDS epidemic control by 2020 under a recent PEPFAR acceleration strategy. The CIFIA Steering Committee meeting provided strategic direction and oversight of the study, which began in August 2017. About 11,000 households have participated thus far and provided blood samples. Preliminary results of the CIFIA are expected by December 2018. These assessments are complex undertakings, and I applaud the high-level commitment and engagement of so many important stakeholders, said U.S. Embassy's chargé d'affaires Catherine Brucker. Representatives from U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, attended the meeting at the invitation of Minister of Health and Public Hygiene, Dr. Ramond Goudou Kofi, who leads the committee and was represented at the meeting by his chief of staff. At the meeting, the CDC country director explained that, when completed, CIFIA will help Côte d'Ivoire better target its HIV prevention and treatment efforts. She also commended the ministry for its leadership and expertise. Representatives from the National Institute of Statistics and the World Health Organization also provided opening remarks at the meeting. Lesotho, Malawi, Swaziland, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe have completed similar PEPFAR-supported population-based HIV impact assessments in the past 18 months. The CDC and other stakeholders, including ICAP at Columbia University, are also assisting governments with these studies. The United States and Côte d'Ivoire have a long-standing partnership on public health that goes back more than 30 years, said Chargé d'Affaires Brucker. We know good data are essential to achieving HIV/AIDS epidemic control, so I am encouraged by these productive discussions on how CIFIA results can be useful.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.